Good evening. My name is Margaret Beatty, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Office of College Relations, it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event, Free the Internet. Traditionally, technology takes time. It took 38 years for radio and 13 years for television to reach an audience of 50 million. But no technology has expanded faster than the internet. It took barely 5 years to reach the 50 million user mark. Today, with almost 22% of the world's population online, the internet has become a vital part of society, modern culture, and our daily lives, which raises very difficult policy questions. We are fortunate to have with us this evening, to address this issue, Chuck Cawson, a member of the class of 1988 who has returned to Dickinson as a Metzger-Conway Fellow. Mr. Cawson graduated from Dickinson with a bachelor's degree in philosophy and later earned a law degree from the George Washington University Law School. Currently, Mr. Cawson is Senior Policy Counsel for Microsoft Corporation. He helps Microsoft with public policy issues in a number of areas, including freedom of expression, human rights, and corporate responsibility. Mr. Cawson has also published a novel, Whitewash, written under the pseudonym Eric Blair. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because the event is being taped and some members of the audience may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has reached you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Chuck Cawson.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Dickinson College and Clark Forum, for having me here. I prepared what I think I referred to before as a good old-fashioned academic lecture. In my line of work in the business world, it's a luxury to be able to address a topic for more than 10 or 15 minutes. And this is definitely one that you can wind it out for a while. So I will, of course, welcome questions at the end of this, but I thought I'd lay out a pretty elaborate and hopefully interesting approach to the question of international human rights, corporate responsibility, and freedom of expression online. I was a philosophy major at Dickinson College in 1988. The year of my graduation was a season of secret military interventions, huge leverage buyouts, and the meltdown of a Democratic presidential candidate. So for all the truth of plus ça change, that aphorism doesn't really hold true. We live right now in a very different world relative to foreign policy and the nature of our executive power and Wall Street speculation. And I think when I finish, we'll see a pattern of evolution, not always change for the better, but certainly a pattern of distinct change from the beginning of the analysis of human rights to the discussion today about human rights business and freedom of expression on the internet. There's a complex set of interrelated questions, and that lends itself appropriately enough to an interdisciplinary, liberal artsy approach. And I just wanted to make one other comment before I talk about what I'm going to talk about, which is that I don't really wouldn't call this a dedication, but I just wanted to take a moment and remember my professor, Cyril Dwiggins, whose presence I feel tonight and whose absence I feel tonight. He was not an easy man to impress. I hope tonight this would have made him proud. But I also wish he was here to tell me where I erred when I get done. But the talk will cover four core concepts, hopefully each building one upon the other. First, we're going to talk a little bit about human rights. Where does human rights come from? And then we're going to talk a little bit about human rights and multinational corporations, and how is it that multinational corporations came to be actors in the arena of human rights, and in particular seen as actors with responsibilities to further the realization of human rights. And then we're going to talk a little bit about, particularly about human rights and multinational internet and technology companies and some of the experiences that my company, Microsoft, has been through and others have been through in recent years. And then I'll close with a description of the Global Network Initiative, which is a multi-stakeholder response that Microsoft and others have put together as a way forward through this set of challenges. So the first part of this talk is by design a little bit on the abstract, but we have to start with, I think, a core question, both because I'm sort of congenitally incapable of doing this any other way than the philosophical way, but also I think it helps set the stage for later parts where we're going to focus more crisply on questions such as, what are the duties of internet companies in relation to human rights? What are the responsibilities of companies to repressive governments? Why don't companies who don't like their policies just tell them we won't follow those policies? These questions, I think, benefit from an examination of where do human rights come from? Or more to the point, where do we get the idea that there's a sphere of individual human dignity which governments and other actors in society are bound to respect? We could answer that question in any number of interdisciplinary, liberal archy kind of ways. We could think about natural law. We could think about religious traditions. We could look at historical analysis. We could look at evolutionary biology. Since I'm trained as a lawyer, I'll probably bore or offend fewer people if I just forswear the attempt at evolutionary biology and stick to some of the skill sets that I developed, such as evidence, precedent, legislative intent, and, of course, good old-fashioned subjective opinion. But one piece of evidence worth considering is the concept of a universal and inviolate sphere of human dignity is not a natural pattern of thought, or it's not a natural set of assumptions. That is, we don't find it existing in all cases, in all societies, or in all historical periods. The rights of Roman citizens differed greatly from those of slaves, an echo of which I'll talk about in a moment. There have been coarse prescriptions on violations of human rights, such as murder, or rape, or theft, other crimes in every society, but whether these stem from a desire to impose social order and discipline or because of a belief in an inviolate sphere of human rights is a question that bears examination. And it also suggests a relationship between the role of the duty of the state and the nature of human rights that I think is worth considering as we move through this discussion. So to pose just a few questions, what do we believe with respect to the authority of the state to abrogate individual rights in order to advance collective or societal goals? Do authoritarian governments have inherently less authority to regulate the activities of their citizens than democratic governments? And do human rights derive from essential qualities of human existence, or do they just derive from the decisions of states? These are questions upon which Plato and Aristotle and Kant and Hegel had much to say, as well as several others who wrote famous and serious and important works that I pretended to read when I was a student here. But let's face it, 19th century German philosophical writing is impenetrably dense. And Plato and Aristotle are only slightly better, although the difficulty meter goes up if you attempt the original Greek, which is another boondoggle I pursued when I was a Dickinson student. But so let me not go down that path, except to say that there are those who would argue that the ideas of Plato and Kant, and Hegel in particular, would have a very important influence on the course of history, and particularly the history that preceded our modern understanding of human rights, and in particular, the 1948 Declaration of Universal Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I will talk about in more detail a little bit down the road. But since we're here at Dickinson College, which was founded in the colonial era, I'm going to skip past 19th century Germany and come right back to here. And I was speaking a moment ago about the echo of Rome in differentiating between the human rights of slaves and the human rights of citizens. And this is something which our own national context was forced to consider. The document constituting our existence as a state, the Declaration of Independence, and the document constituting our government, the Constitution, were, we might note, somewhat in tension with each other with respect to the question of inviolate human rights that apply to all. The Declaration, of course, famously said, all men are created equal and with unalienable rights. I think it's unalienable, not inalienable, but somebody can fact check that. But unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the last, of course, being everyone's favorite right. Without it, would we have ever had Tim Leary or Donald Trump or Paris Hilton, I wonder? But before I digress, let me come back to the point, which is that for all the vaunted and justified accolades about the bravery of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, including, of course, one John Dickinson, they signed something which they truly did not believe or which they knew to be false in practice. And this is an observation we'll be able to make about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as well, which was signed in 1948, which, of course, predates such civil rights landmarks as the 1954 Brown versus Board decision in our own country. So anyway, I meant to say the Constitution, the document constituting the government of the United States, provides in the plain terms of Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3, that taxation and congressional representation shall be determined in proportion to population. How do we measure population? Well, we add to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and we skip the Indians not taxed, we add 3/5 of all other persons. What persons counted not as citizens but as 3/5? I think you know the answer and the reasons why. The Negro slaves were considered property. And in the understanding of the times, to tax the southern states based on full population would have been to tax them, in their view, not on population, but on population plus property. So this was indeed a dispute that had to be worked out as a compromise in our Constitution. But it was not, clearly, an embodiment of the statement in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. And so, you know, there may be historians here who can elaborate more on this, but I think what it illuminates is that there was not an assumption commonly held amongst the people who decided to form the government such that we could have a constitution that without dispute indicated that equality and liberty and privacy and freedom of expression, for that matter, applied to every human being. So bringing us back now to Dickinson College, I wanted to mention just by point of comparison, I went to George Washington University Law School, and among its alumni, we can count J. Edgar Hoover, Reed Smoot, who authored the Smoot-Hawley Tariff that precipitated the Great Depression, and Alan Dulles, who was, I think, famous for giving acid to CIA experimenters. So every college or university has its interesting alumni, but I'm going to pick on ours. Specifically James Buchanan and Roger Brooke Taney. Taney, of course, being the author of the 1857 Dred Scott decision that said, at the time of the Constitution's drafting, the state of public opinion in regard to what he called the unfortunate race, which was a kind of nice note of sympathy in what was otherwise unfortunate in his remarks, which is that he went on to say, all persons of African descent, free or otherwise, were considered beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Thus says the Supreme Court. Well, whether Tani's intentions were judicial or judicious, I think everyone remembers what happened next. The attempts of Tani and Buchanan, which they orchestrated, and let's be honest, they orchestrated them in ways that the separation of powers wouldn't exactly respect, but they attempted to arrest the spread of national dissension over the slavery question and failed. And as you may know from Ken Burns, a war followed. And Buchanan's successor became famous for growing a beard and inspiring a toy set of building logs and succeeding in preserving the Union. And he'd also delivered just down the road from here a breathtaking funeral oration, which commences with that Declaration of Independence phrase, our forefathers brought forth a new nation dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So as Gary Wills has written about that precise moment, Lincoln not only saved the Union, the words spoken at Gettysburg show how Lincoln also established the nation on firmer footing and healed the original sin of the Constitution. And he did so not only by winning the war, but by doing so in a manner that left the political groundwork for the 13th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution to stand as accepted bulwarks and to stand guard over the infancy of the birth of the infancy of a new birth of freedom. One interesting tactical lesson is that Lincoln proceeded to secure these rights carefully through a long project of building political support, of faithfulness to the rule of law, of hewing closely, more or less, to his authority as commander-in-chief, the carefully worded and legalistic Emancipation Proclamation being one case in point. And I think this informs as well the question of whether corporations should engage in civil disobedience, even on matters as principled and as sacred and as solid as inviolate human rights. Or when faced with laws and regulations that unduly constrain human rights, whether there are more interesting but hopefully more solid ways forward. So the point I wanted to make with all of this history lesson is twofold. One is the concept of fundamental human rights, such that anyone, including multinational companies, are bound to respect, is inextricably tied up with systems of law and the relationship of the state to the individual. And the second point is that the concept of human rights has evolved. It's not something that has been around forever and ever, although some people could point back to various biblical instruments for various statements of human rights. The concept certainly has evolved, and we find that there are declarations of various types that, though they don't possess binding legal character, inspire the kinds of activities and statements that we want to see take place, and then they're the less ideal but more operational and legally binding documents of government, like the Constitution. So I've dwelt here on American law and human rights. One could look to the Magna Carta, as I said, or other ancient documents, or even the rights of man that Lafayette presented in the same year that the decision on our own Constitution was reached. And there is a kind of comforting commonality in terms of the specific rights that these instruments have identified. Civil and political rights, such as the right to equal treatment before the law, protections of privacy against arbitrary search or arrest, the right to freedom of expression, and often economic and social rights, such as a right to a family or the right to protection of children or the right to practice a religion. The building blocks, Articles 1 and 2 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, reference liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Or, if you'll pardon my pronunciation, liberté, égalité, et fraternité. And I like framing the discussion of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights with the references to early American thought, not only so I can nitpick Dickinson alumni, but because I think the understanding about how this declaration offers as a aspirational statement that we issued at the creation of the act of statement of our creation of our country is indicative of what we can understand about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The similarity is not entirely accidental. The Declaration of Independence created this wrinkle that I spoke of, that Lincoln observed, about all men being created equal at a time in which that principle was not an honest practice commonly followed. And the Declaration of Human Rights, signed by the UN General Assembly in the Palais de Chaillot in 1948 in newly liberated France, was intended similarly to signal a state of conviction and to serve as an inspiration. Eleanor Roosevelt was among those that believed the UN General Assembly should adopt a declaration that set a very high standard, rather than seeking to negotiate a treaty that would be accepted as binding by governments, but would have required concessions in its language, as I noted earlier, even perhaps concessions by the United States, if we were to be honest about our own human rights practices in 1948. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is not itself a treaty. It has no binding force other than that of moral clarity and a collective exhortation to action. And it created a wrinkle of its own. In this case, a wrinkle in the concept that human rights involve exclusively questions of individual relation to state power. That is a wrinkle in the idea that human rights are those derived from the actions of whatever government you may happen to fall under, but also in the sense of who is obligated to work towards their realization. The preamble to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights provides, "Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts, which have outraged the conscience of mankind." I think you know what he's talking about there. Adolf Hitler passed racist and discriminatory laws in 1933. He conducted or condoned racist and discriminatory violence, as well as political assassinations of former rivals and military officers, and plotted the overthrow of foreign governments in Austria and Czechoslovakia in 1938. He launched unjustified or false pretext military operations in 1939. And before long, he began to organize systematic murders of whole towns, provinces, and religious groups. And he did so in part because the conscience of mankind was not spurred to action. So on the minds of the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was the reaction, or maybe I should say non-reaction, of the Western world to events going on in Europe at the time. And so today, remembrance of those crimes, discussions of contemporary genocide, such as Rwanda or Darfur, often reference the observation attributed, I think not quite correctly, to Edmund Burke, that all that is necessary for evil is for good men to do nothing. And so the Universal Declaration states as its end that every individual and every organ of society, keeping this declaration constantly in mind, shall strive by teaching and education to promote respect for these rights and freedoms, and by progressive measures to secure their universal and effective recognition and observance. Every organ of society shall strive to promote respect for these rights and freedoms. From this, we derive the modern concept that non-state actors, including multinational corporations, are obliged to respect human rights. Many now believe the Universal Declaration of Human Rights forms part of customary international law, law binding on international states by virtue of widespread indications of intent to be bound by a particular provision or rule. UN conferences have said they consider the Universal Declaration an obligation on all members of the international community. It's inspired two binding treaties, of course, the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights and on Economic and Social Rights. And those conventions have been ratified, in some cases with exceptions, by dozens of nations. And international law's traditional concern with the actions of sovereign states was changed in many respects by the way in which the international community reacted to and expressed its reactions in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Corporations, of course, have always been subject to law, And, of course, there are entities that exist by operation of law. And these laws, in many respects, were created to protect shareholders from claims against the business by creating a separate legal entity to shoulder those responsibilities, and in so to sponsor entrepreneurship and business formation and wealth creation, and the furtherance, as it happens thereby, of economic and social rights. Corporations have long been subject to claims in tort for harms occurring as a result of their actions, and subject to laws and regulations by the governments in which they do business, such as health and safety regulations or fair labor or anti-pollution laws. But several events in the last 15 years have brought to light a set of challenges created by the growth of corporations that operate not only internationally, buying and selling goods from one country to another, but operated what was first called transnationally. That is, they operate across borders in multiple jurisdictions at a given time. And therefore, they operate in a sense with multiple identities. An entity subject at once to the domestic laws of a given country where you may have operations, or you've hired employees or incorporated a presence, or in some way where the government can get a jurisdictional hook in you, but at the same time operating independently of all of those. And then there are, in some cases, stark differences between the laws of the home nation of a corporation and the new markets, particularly those in non-Western and developing nations. And this created a bit of a conflict. In some cases, that the identity of values of the company were being compromised by the way in which they operated in some sort of quasi-colonial fashion in some cases. And the impact that those actions had on the welfare of the citizens in a developing world market. In some cases in which they were operating completely consistent with local conditions, but operating without sufficient respect for rule of law or a lack of high environmental standards. So there exists an absence of what international standards should govern at the strictly legal level. And to answer the question of what responsibilities corporations hold, we might start just by looking at a specific example. So as a result of the post-colonial opening of developing markets and globalizations, Western companies began to locate operations and interact with local governments around the world in new ways. And one specific event that I highlight here in this particular slide that I think in many respects sparked the modern understanding of corporations and their responsibility for human rights was the murder of Ken Saro-Wiwa. Saro-Wiwa was a political activist who believed that a Nigerian dictator named Sani Abacha was utilizing resources and support from the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company to constrain the rights of his tribe, the Ogoni, and in particular their rights to territory that Shell Oil was using for oil production, and that Abacha was protecting Shell from responsibility for pollution that they were causing on the territory that the Ogonis claimed. Saro-Wiwa's death by hanging at the hands of Abacha's forces was a fundamental turning point in our understanding of human rights and of the responsibilities of corporations for respecting and protecting those rights. Whether one believes Abacha's oppression of the Ogoni stemmed from his specific support of Shell's activities, or whether one believes Shell could have had some influence on Abacha's decision to murder 9 Ogoni leaders, the company's attempt to distance itself from the situation and to claim an identity as purely an economic and non-political actor did not meet with support from the world community, and particularly non-governmental organizations who started staging campaigns and denouncing Shell for its complicity in these abuses. In some cases, going so far as to support sabotage against Shell facilities. But the argument that Shell operated in a business bubble, separate and indifferent from the political and social conditions in the country of its operations, simply did not persuade. Anyone who's seen Spider-Man knows that with great power comes great responsibility. And in the case of Shell's responsibility to safeguard the environment and the community in which it operated, there really is no issue. In responsibility, in the question of its responsibility to distribute its profits more equitably than the dictator Abacha might have wished is a tougher question. And tougher still is whether its responsibility extends so far as to taking sides in a political debate or in somehow resisting the policies of dictators or authoritarian governments in the market where it does business. But even where certain laws violate international standards, companies are not in a position to determine the laws of the markets in which they operate. They are, of course, in a position to determine in which markets they will operate, but in many cases, their withdrawal from the market leaves the residents worse off, removing the economic or other gains that their presence would produce, and leaving the market to what might be an even less scrupulous competitor. These realities can leave some in the international community a bit dissatisfied. Shouldn't we be insisting on principled actions no matter what the consequences? And this can be problematic for many who believe that the national laws of or the practices of governments like Abacha's, which violate international law, are themselves thereby invalid and do not deserve respect. Or who believe the tremendous power of a multinational corporation is such that its influence alone can persuade governments to change their laws and policies so as to better realize human rights. I was honored to be part of the celebration this past December of the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which took place in the very Palais de Chaillot where the document was signed. And at that seminar, we took up this precise issue, whether international law creates or should codify binding legal standards on multinational corporations with regard to human rights. And a brief answer to that issue. On one hand, such standards do exist. As I noted earlier, corporations are always subject to claims in tort or where companies voluntarily take on obligations or represent that they follow good practices and advertise them to customers and then don't follow through, they can be subject to claims under the rubric of truth in advertising or under investment laws. But at the same time, there is no international consensus in many respects as to what the duties of multinational corporations is, particularly with respect to the proposition that they would disobey the duly enacted laws of sovereign governments, whether those governments be democratic or not. But the business and human rights company is coming to a rough consensus around the idea that there are responsibilities in this area. One outcome of the Shell experience in Nigeria was the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights, which is a code of conduct for oil and other extractive industries. Major multinationals developed this along with the U.S. and British governments and NGOs such as Amnesty International. These principles call for corporations to conduct risk assessments before locating operations or making other important decisions. Calls for them to publicly report any instances of human rights violations by host governments and to hold regular consultations with host governments and civilian leaders regarding security arrangements. These principles were an important step, but a salient feature that they lacked was an accountability and governance function. What did it mean for a company to sign on to the voluntary principles? How were the public or the governments or the NGOs to know for sure that they were being followed? There were developed also a variety of other industry-specific or sector-specific initiatives. There's an extractive industries transparency initiative, for one, focused on anti-corruption objectives. There's the global Sullivan principles regarding were developed for doing business in apartheid South Africa. The Couch Roundtable principles for business and international peace operations, associations code of conduct, and a variety of other examples. The Fair Labor Association, for example, monitors companies with respect to their respect for labor rights. And there are questions about land use and water use and supply chain issues, ensuring that the partnerships a company forms or the raw materials that it uses do not unwittingly involve the company in contributing to human rights abuses. Examples include companies' efforts to vet the source of key minerals, a substance called coltan, important compound in commercial electronics that can sometimes be mined under abusive or conflict-torn circumstances. And at a more macro level, there have been a number of attempts to establish guidelines for multinational corporations. And one such was developed by the OECD, 39 OECD governments, who developed guidelines that said, enterprises should take fully into account established policies in the countries in which they operate and consider the views of other stakeholders. And in this regard, enterprises should respect the human rights of those affected by their activities, consistent with the host government's international obligations and commitments. These were welcomed by many, but considered weak tea by rather weak tea by others. The consistent with the host government's international obligations and commitments, for example, or take into account policies in countries where they operate, did not resonate entirely with the idea of universal, inviolate, unalienable human rights that persist regardless of what individual governments, including non-democratic governments, may adopt as laws and policies. So again, a set of standards was attempted, the UN norms on transnational corporations. This set of principles, drafted in 1999 under the auspices of the UN Human Rights Commission, an entity since replaced by the UN Human Rights Council, did not seek to create legal norms, but rather extended the duties of states to non-state actors. And it called for periodic monitoring and verification to ensure compliance. In order to make these obligations not entirely open-ended, however, the UN norms limited business responsibility to actions within their respective spheres of activity and influence. Notwithstanding a strong push by NGOs, including Amnesty International, these norms did not gain traction either, particularly in the business community. In my view, with good reason. For one, the idea of creating a limited list of rights for which business is responsible is inevitably going to be implemented in an arbitrary way. Also, you know, business can potentially impact just about any human right, given the context in which they're operating. But also, I think it's inappropriate and subject to many challenges in practical implementation to entangle the roles of states and the roles of non-state actors, such as corporations. It becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to tell who's responsible for what, and to formulate an answer to a particular scenario, taking into account the respective roles of governments in enacting laws and policies and regulations. So what we was developed toward the middle of this decade from an initiative by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was to craft an approach that would work for business, consist of voluntary commitments, but yet still be sufficiently categorical about imposing upon business certain obligations should they choose to take up those commitments. This approach is known as the Global Compact, and Microsoft is a signatory to it. The Global Compact consists of 10 principles governing the areas of human rights, labor standards, environment, and anti-corruption, and I've reproduced them here in full. The first two principles regarding human rights provide businesses should support and respect the protection of internationally proclaimed human rights. And principle two, make sure they are not complicit in human rights abuses. The general consensus about the Global Compact is that it was a reasonable success. Some in the NGO and investor community are still concerned that it lacks an accountability mechanism that is sufficiently effective for them, but it does have some accountability measures to it. On one hand, it is a big tent, and I think there's merit in a broad statement of belief that businesses should support and respect the protection of human rights. On the other hand, some are concerned that it does not set the bar high enough. So if the Sino Chinese oil company is allowed to be a member in the Global Compact, for example. Some feel that it's not tough enough with respect to its standards. So because business and human rights and governments yet desired some greater clarity around the expectations and standards of business, the UN Secretary General appointed a special representative who, pursuant to a mandate from the UN Human Rights Council, conducted extensive research and consultation to develop a further framework for understanding business and human rights issues. And on April 7th, 2008, the special representative, Professor John Ruggie of Harvard, published Protect, Respect, and Remedy, a framework for business and human rights, and presented it to a broad and welcome reception to the UN Human Rights Council. This framework is depicted up here. In relevant part, the document that he presented to the UN Human Rights Council observes that the root cause of the business and human rights predicament lies in the governance gaps created by globalization. Between the scope and the impact of the economic forces that multinational corporations can bring to bear, and the capacity of societies to manage their adverse consequences. Or as I'll say in a minute, I think, with respect to the internet, the capacity of societies to manage their operations at all, adverse and beneficial. The framing of policy challenges has a profound consequence for how we assign responsibilities for human rights among the state, among non-state actors. And so here we reiterate that the international consensus is states have the primary duty to protect human rights, but we articulate a duty of corporations to respect human rights. To respect human rights essentially means not to infringe on the rights of others, or to put it in medical terms, to do no harm. And what this means in practice for business is due diligence and risk management. And then, of course, there's the third pillar, which is individuals should have access to remedies. And the best of all circumstances, there will be disputes over human rights. And then the question becomes what recourse is available. And I think that is a question which is a little bit still open-ended. But thinking about this as a scope of what human rights are and what are the duties of corporations with respect to them gives us, I think, the foundation we need to now turn to, in particular, the rights of freedom of expression and privacy and the internet. Visually depicted here is not some nebula. This is not from the Carl Sagan archives, but a visual depiction of the interconnected nodes endpoints of the internet. And as I observed a moment ago, the root cause of lots of thinking about the predicament of human rights is the gap between the governance capabilities of society and the impact of the economic forces, or in the case of the internet, not simply economic forces, but cultural forces, political forces, and the realization of individual human potential that it affords. There are, of course, externalities and risks associated with the internet. Identity theft and forms of fraud, trade in child pornography, other forms of contraband, and at Microsoft we consider this a particularly egregious abuse, trade in stolen software. But government responses to these safety concerns take much the same form as, say, government responses to the political speech of a dissident. And demands that technology companies restrict access to content inappropriate for children take much the same form as demands that technology companies restrict the available of politically sensitive or unpopular or content threatening to the stability of a particular government. So how we craft a set of guidelines to help companies observe the duty to respect human rights has to take into account these safety and other public objectives with respect to the health and social order of the societies that they govern. But we have to take into account, of course, also the nature of the internet. The internet is notoriously difficult for sovereign governments to manage. At the same time, governments can and will do so. And the nature of the internet is such that the characteristics of its architecture and how its businesses are structured impact the ability of governments to take these kinds of actions. So let me take a moment to point out a few of the characteristics of the internet that create this gap between the capabilities of the network and the capability of government or society to manage its use. For one, the internet was built without an identity layer. To access an airplane, you have to present a government ID. To access a particular website, you may have to present nothing more than a username and password that you yourself created. The internet was built without a way to know who or what you are talking to. So we have this combination Library of Congress broadcast megaphone that is accessible by lots of individuals with perhaps ill intent and an inability to tell the good from the bad, at least, or to provide an identification for the entity that you want to hold accountable. Yes, you may need to sign up with a billing account with a particular service provider, but once you are on the network, that provider will typically assign you a dynamic internet protocol address, which is a label for your particular endpoint. That label data and the time and date stamp that allows law enforcement to identify which particular computer was using that particular address when a particular action occurred are one, ways that law enforcement uses commonly to identify and hold accountable people for wrongdoing on the internet, but they are also not stored permanently by the provider. Storage times vary from 60 days to 2 years, depending on what jurisdiction the provider is subject to. And thus we have active policy debates around the globe as to these data retention rules. But at the same time, it's not terribly difficult to hide the location of an originating computer. Tools like proxy servers and onion routers, we have some people from the computer science department here who can explain those work in more detail. But these are relatively easy to access. The internet works, as my friend Professor Jonathan Zittrain described it, like a mosh pit. Which is to say, I have a packet, and it's got a destination, but the way it gets there is it's essentially passed from hand to hand by the good graces of the person next to you until it reaches its destination. And the receiving address may know or only need to know the next link in the chain, not the ultimate originating address. So as the cartoon says, there is little on the internet to indicate to another user that you are a dog, or the fraudster, or that anonymous person who called you a nasty name, or which would enable governments to identify anonymous political bloggers, at least absent service of process on an internet provider for the types of address and time and date stamp information. So for one thing, the internet affords these qualities of anonymity, and on the other hand, the internet is never totally private. The anonymous authors of the Federalist Papers or the Primary Colors or even Eric Blair, author of Whitewash, could have, in theory, remained anonymous forever if only the people who actually knew who was the author would have kept their mouth shut. Manuscripts can be written and dropped off in pumpkins in total anonymity. But on the internet, because the network needs to know some other point, anonymity in total is not possible. And the same time, the interactions online permit a level of anonymity that face-to-face interactions do not, both with respect to identity and to physical locality or nationality, which are important sources of jurisdiction. And I emphasize jurisdiction in part because that is where the government establishes its right or its authority to indicate to a corporation whether it would restrict the content of a particular user or whether it would require personal information. Two persons in Brazil may trade a file from one to the other through a server located in Ireland. A web surfer in France can browse online auctions powered by equipment located in California. Does the law of Brazil govern this transaction that transacts through a facility in Ireland? Does France have jurisdiction over a service powered by equipment located in California? And what if California and France have very, very different ideas about what the law should be? And if California and France have indeed very different views of what the law should be, can France limit what people in California should be allowed to see? Can France order a provider in California to remove content for the entire world? Or can a France order a service in California to block delivery of such content if the requesting address appears to be from France? Generally speaking, the answer to the former question is no, but the answer to the former question is yes. This, as you might guess, is an actual case. The 1999 case of La Ligue contre le Racisme, again, pardon my pronunciation, versus Yahoo, in which Yahoo was taken to French court for the expression or the presence on its services of Nazi memorabilia in its auction sites. And the French court insisted that Yahoo remove this content, at least so insofar as to not deliver it to users who appeared to be from France. So different countries view the appropriate scope of permitted expression differently. All countries respect free speech to some degree, and such restrictions as necessary to protect the public health and morals and order on free speech are permitted expressly by Article 19. Freedom of speech was one of Roosevelt's four freedoms enshrined prominently in the Universal Declaration. Freedom of speech is protected by Article 35 of the Constitution of the People's Republic of China. So all countries have positions on freedom of speech that express sentiment that it is a protected human right. But all countries have different opinions as to what types of speech can be permitted and what type should be restricted. So whether it is the lèse majeste laws in Thailand that prohibit insults to the king, or laws in Turkey that prohibit content denigrating to Ataturk, or laws in Europe that prohibit advocacy of anti-Semitism or publication of Mein Kampf, even the laws around the world that prohibit publication of defamation or invasions of privacy or certain forms of sexual content differ greatly in the scope and types of things that they are restricted. So drawing lines around this has been an interesting exercise. One of the phenomena that we see is as governments begin to enact all of these types of laws around the globe, it becomes very difficult for one government to single out another government as having violated these international standards. But in the case of internet companies, that was exactly what took place in 2006 and 2007. The three internet companies you see depicted here, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Google, all established in various ways operations in China, and in doing so became subject in various ways to laws of the government of China respecting freedom of expression. In the case of Microsoft, the notorious event was the removal of a blog by a blogger named Michael Anti, a pseudonym, and Michael Anti had published certain information about the inner workings of a newspaper and why a certain editor had been fired. In the case of Google, they offered a Google.cn search service, which produced very different results for certain types of search terms than did the Google.com service. In particular, if you searched Google.com for Tiananmen Square, you got many pictures from June 1989. If you searched Google.cn for the same terms, you got a nice picture of Tiananmen Square and cherry blossoms. And Yahoo, in some cases, became the most notorious. Yahoo had established operations in China in which it stored personal information, this IP address and time and date stamp that I spoke of earlier. And one day, a journalist named Shi Tao sent an email from his work email computer through his Yahoo email account to a friend in the United States in a pro-democracy group. And what Shi Tao sent was notes of his meeting that he had earlier in the day, where it had been explained to him exactly how they were not going to talk about the events of June 1989 at its upcoming anniversary. So Yahoo was some days shortly thereafter served with a subpoena asking them to provide confirmation that Shi Tao's email address had been logged into that particular IP address at that particular time, which Yahoo provided. This evidence was used to form a case against Shi Tao for violation of Chinese state secrets laws, and he's now serving 10 years in prison. Or as Congressman Tom Lantos put it at a February 2006 congressional hearing, 10 long years in a Chinese dungeon. And Congressman Lantos, who is sadly no longer with us, was a great champion of human rights and would not be at all the first elected official to engage in political theater. But the generative impact of that political theater was to prompt these three companies to think quite a bit more closely about how they structure their operations in China, whether they should follow through in the types of due diligence that I explained a moment ago as to the consensus of what responsibility for international human rights entails. And one of the things that came out of those long discussions was this, the Global Network Initiative. And what the Global Network Initiative provides in brief is a set of principles, a set of operational guidelines, and a set of practices and procedures by which participating companies will be held accountable for the implementation of its principles. And some of the specific things that it says we will go do include insisting on the rule of law, restricting the impact of government regulation of free speech, and working collaboratively with non-governmental organizations, academics, and investors to try and find paths forward, to work through problems, to learn more about the complex challenges that we face around the globe. Very interesting in that respect as well, in that it truly is an instance in which the company sat down with those who had concerns about their practices and collaboratively worked out a way forward. Where we hope to go from here, I think, will emphasize that bit of shared learning, because the challenges are as big as the entire world. Internet companies today face a number of challenges with respect to free expression and privacy. In Turkey and in Thailand, as I mentioned earlier, in Vietnam and Egypt, in interesting cases like places like Australia, where the government proposes to require all network providers of connectivity to the internet to filter a secret government list. In Argentina, where content of prominent figures have been removed from search engines because of claims of defamation. And in the United States, where network companies and others have been involved in government surveillance, which may or may not comport with either international privacy or U.S. law. The companies involved in the internet sector see these issues all around the world, and in that sense, the principles that we look to adopt are going to be global in impact. So a great deal has changed. There are some familiar patterns and tensions between order and freedom, between privacy and public accountability, the need to recognize these in a way that makes life fruitful and helps individuals realize their personal potential. But there is much that's different from even in 2006 when we began to craft the Global Network Initiative, from 2004 when the UN Special Representative started his work to craft the framework for business and human rights. Certainly from the mid-90s when the murder of Ken Saro-Wiwa awoke a number of concerns about the growing economic impact of multinational corporations. And I should say, certainly from 1948 and from 1857 when my fellow alumni authored Dred Scott. Let me stop there and we'll happily take some questions. And I was told to expect some from the back row, I believe.
I'll throw one in while the back row is getting ready there. To my knowledge, Google is unique among the big web services companies in having an explicit mission stated by its founders in the area of corporate social responsibility. They have said that Google will, quote, do no evil, end quote. How do you think Google is doing on this mission?
That's a great question. Well, first I would say a couple of things. One is I think I can't speak for Google. Two, I think over at Microsoft, there are some who wonder whether the corporate statement about don't be evil wasn't maybe directed at us. And thirdly, I would note that within the Global Network Initiative, we work rather closely with Google and Yahoo in forming this. And they have been a very, I think, important partner in thinking through what kind of principles are going to be operational for companies, what kind of steps that they can then take when they're operating in challenging circumstances. So I think Google is, from where I sit as Microsoft, doing reasonably well in that perspective. And we do care about that at Microsoft. Certainly we don't want to sign up to principles and guidelines and be the only one at the party who's actually doing them. So we'll be interested in holding Google account to that as well.
Chuck, you covered a lot of ground from the 18th century to the 21st century and a lot of different issues. The one thought arises in my mind is that back in the 18th century, the world was the same size, but different cultures and whatnot lived at such distance from one another that in a way people were more able to get along with less friction just because of the distance. Do you look upon the internet that one of the true challenges is that as it brings the world closer together, the friction increases?
Yes. I'm picking up the. Yes. I mean, I think one of the principles and guidelines that we try and follow in setting both corporate terms of use for our service as well as it within the GNI is to not let the policies of one country dictate what the rest of the world gets to see. But there are plenty of countries who are concerned about that, and I'll just pick on the United States for one. The Congress passed a law that said if you're going to put sexually explicit content on the law, you've committed a crime. However, you can have a defense if you put it behind some sort of credit card verification or age screen like that. And it was pointed out to them that this wouldn't really address the problem of foreign websites with such content, to which the Justice Department argued, oh, but it applies to foreign websites too, which, you know, was a kind of interesting observation considering the legislative history said exactly the opposite. But on top of that, since when does the U.S. government get off regulating foreign websites hosted in France or Germany or Argentina or thereabout? So there are governments that are absolutely interested in continuing those boundaries so that they can keep the world that they way they want it, that they want their citizens to experience within the walls of policy that they may have set. But the internet just doesn't work that way.
I have a slightly related question, which is that one sees a lot of conversations lately to the effect that the existing internet is about to be swamped between spam and criminality, to the extent that there are ongoing discussions about the possibility of Internet 2. I saw an interesting article recently in which somebody involved in speculation about the design of a second Internet was pointing out that there was a fundamental problem, that is to say, if you really want to control crime, spam, etc., you have to have addresses and identities of every sender as a condition of getting access to the web. And on the other hand, we have a kind of a conviction that there's a human right that the internet should be accessible to anyone anonymously. Do you have any sense of where that conversation is likely to go?
That is a great question. And I have a sense of where it was likely to go, which is continued back and forth along quite the boundaries that you described. And I also have a sense of where Microsoft would like it to go. I'd commend to you a set of papers at a site called microsoft.com/end-to-end-trust. And what end-to-end trust observes is, in part for one of the reasons I mentioned, the internet lacks the ability to know who or what you are talking to. We have this level of spam and fraud and cybercrime that I think is unsustainable. And the internet is rife with rich targets, so it's a very attractive place for criminals. So one of the things that we think we want to drive into the internet ecosystem is an ability to make identity claims that are accountable or that are more verifiable, so that you can have trusted code and trusted devices and trusted people. But it's also true that that trusted party you might have to which you can enforce some accountability, say if it actually misuses the service or the network, you can effectively kick it off or restrict it in some way. That trusted person you're talking to may be named Abe Lincoln. Or that trusted person you might have may have nothing more than, "Hi, I'm trusted person one," as an indicia of knowing who they are. And it also requires, I think, that to create this system, we need governments to have a conscientious policy decision to enact restraint, which in some cases is not something that governments are very well suited to doing. So, for example, if I create a credential that says I'm a trusted person and you can trust me and if you can act accordingly with respect to me, but nobody other than the entity who issued me that credential knows who I really am. Under what conditions can the government go find the party who vouched for my trusted status? Can a private investigator do so? Maybe we should enact laws and policies that make that more difficult, that require, say, a warrant or finding of probable cause before that identity is revealed. And I think absent that, we're not going to generate the kind of political trust that we need in order to create a system where things can be more accountable. So it is a little bit of having to address both of the points that you raised. The level of activity, of criminal activity and fraudulent activity on the internet is reaching the kind of proportions where it's difficult to sustain. The way forward has to protect privacy and anonymity. And I remember the article that you allude to in the New York Times, and John Markoff's piece ended, I think, by saying that these were irreconcilable. And, you know, maybe we need a new internet that works with very different rules than the earlier one. And so I think Microsoft has some strong agreement with the idea that, yes, we need to do something, but I think we would reject the false choice between our values and our security, to quote the inaugural address.
Hi. Microsoft is constantly combating software piracy. But given the importance, the primacy of technological development in the developing world, what are the implications of proprietary software in terms of human rights with regards to software piracy?
That is a great question. Let me talk about three implications. One is, as I think you allude to, proprietary software, in the view of some, can impact human rights in the economic and social sphere. And in that sense, what we need to do as Microsoft, this is actually something we talked about in Professor Fratantuono's senior seminar this afternoon, was we need to figure out ways in which proprietary software companies can target markets, particularly those at the bottom of the pyramid, those making under $10,000 a year, with products that we drive as a market-driven solution, things that are affordable for those markets, things that are tailored to meet the needs of those markets. We need to back that up with corporate citizenship activities like community software grants, like the Elevate training, skills and technology training program that we announced last Monday. And we need to think about what are the kinds of impacts that proprietary software can generate. And there have been studies done by IDC and others that show the value of the ecosystem of applications that can be developed on the Windows platform. So I think there are at least three areas in which we need to be continually focused on making sure that we meet the economic and social needs of the communities we serve. There's another kind of implication as well, which was in enforcing intellectual property rights. And we see this in the case of some of the recording industry, and we see this in the case of software piracy as well. And I think there are cases in which you need to be sort of cognizant of the environment in which you're operating in order to make sure that you infect respect for intellectual property through reasonable and appropriate law enforcement steps. But it's interesting, within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there is also articulated a right, effectively, a right to the ownership of works that you create. And so in that sense, you know, the idea of creating another generation of entrepreneurs, some who may come from that bottom of the pyramid set of markets, to create works and to be able to enjoy the fruits of them is actually entirely consistent with the whole spirit of the Universal Declaration.
The question that he asked was fairly in line with what I was going to ask, so I had to come up with something a little different fairly quickly. I guess to piggyback off what you were just talking about, especially regarding to free enterprise on the internet and also ownership of works, how do you feel about Lawrence Lessig and the ideas that he's put forward, especially with reformation to IP laws, as well as the ideas of Creative Commons and things like that?
Okay. Well, in a sense, there's one answer, which is the caveat answer. That's sort of like not my department. We have IP and L experts who speak more directly to that. But without trying to tread on their toes, I could say a couple of things. One is we had Professor Lessig at the campus last month, and he talked about his book, Remix. And I think from a Microsoft perspective, there's a lot of sympathy with his view that overly draconian enforcement of copyright laws, or seeing it as a war, doesn't actually serve the interest for which those copyrights were secured. We prefer much more of a balanced approach between use or fair use and protection of copyrights. The other interesting thing I think that we'd observe is we think the notice and takedown system of the DMCA actually, I think, works reasonably well. And if there are calls for greater activity by network providers, say, to try and block transactions or transmissions of right-protected content, we think those need to be approached pretty carefully.
I believe that concludes our question and answer session.
Please join me in again thanking Chuck Cossum for...
Thank you. Thank you.
On behalf of the Clark Forum, I'd like to present you with a plaque as a token of our appreciation.
Thank you very much.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This concludes our program. Have a nice evening.